Scotland Historical Association near Albany, New York. June and Ken Hunter are interviewing Wayne Allen, who served in the United States Marines from March 21, 1944 to November 1946, and then he served in Korea from July 1950 through 1951. Please tell us your full name and when and where you were born.
Lloyd Wayne Allen, born in Albany, New York.
And when were you born?
9/26/26.
And what did you do before you entered the service?
Well, I was 17 years old. I had already left school, quit early, which I regretted in later years. And I had a variety of jobs. I worked on the New York Central Railroad up in West Albany for a year as a machinist apprentice. I worked for Coca-Cola, doing bottling, and probably a couple other things I don't even remember.
And then did you enlist, or were you drafted into the Marines?
I enlisted.
Oh, why?
I palled around with a few guys that everybody was gung-ho and wanted to serve their country. So three or four of us went down to the old Albany Post Office building, where the recruiting offices were. And we went in and took a physical and went through that routine. And another fellow and myself didn't pass the physical. So we were kind of bummed out about it and stood out in the hallway. And a door, this was at for to go in the Navy. We had gone down to go in the Navy. We wanted to get in the Naval Air Corps, the Air Force. Wanted to fly planes off the carriers, you know, and that, oh yeah, back in those days, that was really something. So this door opened from the Marine recruiting office, and this old gunny sergeant came out. He was a big stocky guy with three up, three down bars on his sleeve and all. Understand you fellows want to get in the service. Yes, sir, but we got turned down, you know. Well, so he talked to us a little bit. He said, did you ever consider going in the Marine Corps? No, we want to fly planes and all that. So he was very persuasive. He was good at what he did. And about 10 minutes later, we had our hands up in the air, and he swore us in right in the hallway. So he was a very jovial guy, and very nice until he swore us in. Then he said, okay, now, 21st of the month, you'll be down at the train station. Be ready to go. This whole attitude changed right then, because we were actually under his command right then, you know, this senior military person. So on the 21st, was down there and got on a train at Albany's Union Station in those days. Went to Parris Island, which was quite an experience because guys were coming in from all over the country, really, and they assembled them at this train place down there. And it was pouring rain, as I recall, when we got off the train. We were standing out there in our civilian clothes, and guys had beautiful haircuts and ties and sport jackets on. And we stood there for about 15 minutes, and I mean, it was pouring rain. And a drill instructor came up and said, attention. Well, we all did what we could to be at attention. We didn't know what attention was even. And he said, follow me. So we followed him. And the first thing they do to you is separate you from all your personal belongings. Put a tag on it. Went into this building and went through delousing showers. That was a standard procedure. So they're just ice cold shower waters and this, I think it was some kind of a pink detergent of some kind, a delouser, you know. Oh, before we went into the showers, they had a barber on each, not a barber, they were other Marines, one on each side, and actually two on each side. So they were standing on little boxes. But as you walked up and stopped, the guys in the front did the back for you. In about 1 second, your hair was gone. Of course, now it wouldn't bother me at all now. And you took one more step and they completed it. You were absolutely bald. You know, some of the guys were, holy then we went through the delousing showers, then went into another building, and they issued us clothing. And they throw you, they ask you what size you were, and then throw you any size clothing. You know, it was to make you feel as poorly as they could, you know, to break you down like that. So after we got out of there, when we finally got to a barracks, we started exchanging clothing, trying to get the right sizes and everything. And one of the drill instructors came in and he said, from now on, when you make your sack, your bed, it'll be done just like this. And he did these things real fast. You couldn't even follow how fast he did it. He takes out a quarter and flips it and it bounces. You know, the blanket was tight. He said, all right, I forget he did the rest of that. Well, that was in the evening, so it was the next morning. 4:30 in the morning, blew a whistle. You know, everybody, what the heck's going on here, you know? Get up. The lights came on. Drill instructor comes in. Fall outside in 10 minutes. You know, mackerel. So trying to get your act together and get outside in 10 minutes was quite an experience. So we did it. And was standing out there at attention, and he said, anybody here ride the range? Oh, a few hands went up, you know, country boys, they were out, it might have been from the Midwest even, someplace, ride the range. So stepped forward, got those guys together, took them right down to the mess hall, and riding the range was the cooking range, which was a huge, old, black, covered with grease range. It was an awful job, and you were putty knifing that stuff off and wiping it down. And then his next question was, anybody here drive? Well, a couple of the guys had driver's licenses, up went the hands, you know. So we learned a very good lesson that day. Never volunteer for Never. Anything. So those guys stepped forward, and they were pushing wheelbarrows. So it was a very effective lesson. Boot camp was tough, you know. I was in pretty good shape. I didn't mind the physical part of it, but the mental part was much harder than the physical. Of course, some guys did wash out on the physical end of it, but and you had to learn to swim. You had to be able to swim. They had a big pool down the road there, and they marched you down there. In perfect formation, you couldn't miss a step or anything. And it was all the confrontation and trying to break you down. And they get this far from your nose and yell at right in your face, you know. And I remember this one great big guy from someplace down in the Ozarks, and he must have been 7 foot tall, and he was huge. And this drill instructor was just a guy small, even smaller than I am. And he got right up in his face and stood right on his feet, with his feet on this big guy's feet. And that guy could have gone wham, would have been the end of him, you know. But so they took us down. If you couldn't swim, they throw you in. They had guys there to pull you out if you didn't make it, you know. But just about everybody could swim, I guess. So we passed that part of it. Oh, I recall on the way down there, they had issued us a bucket with a scrub brush, yellow soap, a towel, white towel. The white towel we had to tuck in the back of our belts and do the duck walk down, you know, and waddle, you know, all the way down about a mile. It was tough on the legs, down to the swimming thing. But it was things like that that made it interesting. Put it mildly. I remember the first night after that, during the night, there were a lot of sobs and crying going on there, you know. Guys trying to bury it in their head in the pillow. But it was such a traumatic experience for them that, you know, it was tough. Well, we got through all that, rifle range and forced marches, and 40-mile hikes, all that sort of thing. And Parris Island is a very hot place, 110 degrees some days, you know. And they march out through these swamps that were all muck, and they had these big land crabs that would walk around. And they'd say, hit the deck. And you'd have to down, don't you get that rifle dirty, you know. And in the meantime, you're laying in all this muck, crawling through it. Keep your head down. And they fire guns over the top of you, so you didn't dare stand up anyway. And eventually, you know, we all toughed up and we got used to what was going on, and eventually we got out of there. I think it was like 12 weeks at that time.
What were meals like in the mess hall, and what did you ever have to pull KP duty?
Oh, yeah. Well, everybody pulled that. The meals, you had plenty to eat, at least during training and while you were in this country. It wasn't the best food in the world. We usually, I think, the quartermaster issued some of the food that the other services didn't cater to or want, you know. We never ate as good as the Army or the Navy, ever, in all the time I was in. So, let's see, where we go next. I was shipped up to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and went through field telephone school, communications. And I learned to climb poles and all that sort of thing. So, graduated from that, and they was somehow down in Cherry Point, North Carolina for a short time. I think it was a dispersion battalion or something. And then we loaded aboard train and went cross country to Camp Pendleton.
And that's in California?
California, yeah, just below San Diego there. There about 3 weeks for a little more training. They called it advanced training. Got aboard ship, went to Pearl Harbor. In Pearl Harbor about a month. And what was going to happen at that time, because it was late in the war already, they had put together this large flotilla of LSTs, landing ship tank, I think 20, 25, of those, and a couple escort ships, and we were loading up supplies and men to invade Japan. Well, we were only there about 3 weeks or so, and they dropped the atom bomb. And Japan at that time capitulated, so instead of going in as a invading force, which would have cost an awful lot of lives, we went as an occupation force. Well, that was the best duty in the Marine Corps I ever had, was in Japan. Actually, I loved Japan. The people were nice over there. There was never, to my knowledge, one act of retribution against an enemy, an invader, or anything like that. The people were great. But we unloaded at Sasebo, Japan, which is on the southern island of Kyushu, a submarine base, Japanese submarine base. And we unloaded, we got there at night, unloaded at night, and they had lights set up. And after we got everything unloaded, everybody was kind of milling around, and there were two Navy men there. I was talking to them, and they said, we want to take a ride, we'll see what it's like in town here. So one of the Navy guys said, I have a Jeep over here. So the three of us piled in the Jeep, and we went into the town. And of course, a lot of the people there had never even seen an American. It was at night. They had all these Japanese lanterns, down the streets. The policemen on the intersections still had their sidearms on them. And here we are, and we're away from all the other military personnel. So the people along the sidewalk, as we came down the street and the word spread, got down on their hands and knees, put their head down, their face right on the curb, you know, and stayed that way as we went down the street. Well, you know, we were amazed that this happened that way. But it was something of interest that somebody might be interested in. And some of us had some candy in our pockets. We passed it out. The kids, they didn't care. They'd run right up to the Jeep, little children, you know. We gave them all candy. And so we took a little tour around town. It wasn't a great big town, maybe the size of Delmar and something like that. And got ourselves back without getting arrested or anything. So I spent a year in Japan and I really liked it. I mean, we did an awful lot of work there.
What kind of work did you do in Japan as occupation forces?
Well, because I was in the communications, we ran all the telephone wire, set up the switchboards, did troubleshooting. No, in general, kept communications going. And it was a little rough to do. I mean, we worked every single day of the week, you know, all day long. It was a lot of work. But when you had a little time to yourself, you'd walk around in town. Everyone was great. I remember going to a barber shop there, and Japanese barbers in there, and sitting down in that chair and wondering, all they have to do with one of those straight razors is go, you're gone, you know. And you never knew really how they would react. But I had never heard of an incident of any kind like that. So that was good. And then they established a military currency over there. It was a military yen script, they call it. And 1 yen, as issued by the military, was 6 2/3 cents. Now, 6 2/3 cents would, over there, 1 yen would buy you about a half-gallon bottle of Asahi Red Label beer, for one thing. Buy you lodging for a couple yen with meals. If you had some time off, you could go someplace and check into one of their so-called hotels, which were not much at that time. I mean, things were very primitive over there. We used to go down to the waterfront, and the fishermen, when they came in, had baskets of shrimp, what they call prawns, the large shrimp. And you could buy a basket of shrimp for 1 yen. And if you wanted, for another yen, they'd clean all the shrimp and everything. Because we were living on a GI chow, which wasn't all that great, you know. And we got so sick of eating shrimp, to this day, I don't even like it. But that was another experience we had there.
When you arrived over in Japan there for the occupation or after the atomic weapons were dropped, by any chance, did you see any big wheeled dignitaries like MacArthur? Did you see the battleship Missouri?
No, I didn't. Another incident that happened that might be of interest, when this flotilla of ships were on our way to occupy there, we went through the worst typhoon they had ever had in the South Pacific. And of course, we were on mostly LSTs, and they were kind of a flat bottom scow with the flat doors in the front that opened up and they'd drive the trucks out. And because of the overloading, there really were no bunks down below for some. I was one of the last to get on the ship that I was on. And he said, there's no more room down below. You have to sleep on deck. So a Navy guy there had a hammock, and I got hold of that. And I slung it up under a forward gun tub on the starboard, no, port side of the ship, in the front, in the bow. And these gun tubs set up on, well, very similar to that stand right there with the legs. Mm-hmm. They had four legs on there, steel legs about this high off the deck. So I slung the hammock up against the bottom of the gun tub for protection from rain and everything. Well, we got out a little way a couple of days later, ran into this typhoon, and of course, none of us at that time thought we'd ever survive the thing. It was so bad. An LST does about 11 knots forward, and we were going backwards about 20 knots. And a couple of them lost their steering. It was chaos. But for 2 days and nights, I never got out of that hammock. Couldn't, because the water would come up over, hit that front and come up over the top, down, and it would be just a sheet of water coming down right to the deck, you know. So, actually, I didn't eat anything for 2 days. And go to the bathroom, you just had to do whatever you had to do, you know. But I never got out of that hammock for 2 days. So after surviving that anyway, we finally got to Japan, and that was good duty.
And what happened after that? How did you get back to the States?
I'm thinking back 50-some years now.
Did you had to amass a series of points to be able to come back?
Yeah, you did.
And you had the required number of points that allowed you to come back?
Yes.
And did they ship you back on transport?
I'm trying to think how we came back.
Well, you did come back to the States eventually.
We know he didn't walk.
No.
Or swim.
I'm not sure if we were aboard of what they called an APA. That was a personnel carrier. It had to be that.
It was probably a troop transport.
Yeah, it was. Trying to think, we flew back someplace, but no, that was from Korea to Japan after the Korean War. Yeah, but it was aboard ship.
So you came, and is it at that time that you then left the service, or did you do something else after you got back from Japan?
No, I left the service at that time. I was discharged.
Because your two-year contract was up, or?
Well, there was no, it was an open-ended contract, really.
Duration of the war.
They could have kept me for 10 years, I suppose, if hostilities had gone on.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And what did you do when you got out? What kind of work?
I didn't really have any trade of any kind. So I did some plumbing work for a while, did some painting. Well, we went to work for the Natural Gas Corporation in Albany, and they were, at that time, converting Albany over to natural gas from manufactured gas. So everybody was changing stoves and water heaters and furnaces, and we did a lot of that kind of work. I did that for quite a while. Then got in with this ex-Marine I was talking about there, and we started doing mason work, building block foundations and that sort of thing for Reddy Brothers and all me. And that's when he talked me into going into the active reserve. And not too long after that, I was on my way to Korea.
So did you notice any changes in how you were treated when you went back into the reserves, as opposed, what were some of the differences?
It was not near as tough when I went in the second time. Standards were relaxed a lot more. Marine to the old Marines, it was a downgrading of capabilities and everything, you know. But still, it was a Marine Corps.
And where did you first go after you?
Where were you assigned to?
We got together at the Scotland Avenue Armory in Albany, marched down to the Union Station again, got aboard trains, and headed across country. It was very hot at that time, no air conditioning on it. It was a troop train. I distinctly remember that if we stopped where the Red Cross was, there were lots of stops along the way, they were picking up more personnel. If we stopped where the Red Cross was, I don't know if I should even say this or not, they would charge us for the coffee and donuts that they had set up there. At the next stop would be the Salvation Army. Never charged us, ever. And the guys kind of, you know, they remember these kind of things. Along with that, when we were in, the women back home here would knit these sweaters and things for the troops. Everybody was really gung-ho at that time. There was a lot of patriotism. And when they shipped some of those over and the Red Cross distributed these sweaters and so forth, they would charge you for them. Now, it doesn't sound like much now. It was maybe $3, $4, something like that. Of course, our pay was only $52 a month, so relatively speaking. And then when the Salvation Army distributed those sweaters, there was no charge at all. Another incident along with that, I don't know if I put that down. I was at Greenville, North Carolina, and I was in a photographic squadron at that time. That's as near as I ever got to the, being near planes and all. And I got a telegram that my brother had been badly hurt. He was a younger brother, a year younger than I was. So I didn't have any money or anything. They rarely paid us in the Marine Corps anyway. They'd give you enough to buy shaving stuff and like that, but not enough to have any fun with. So I walked into town. The air base was about a mile out of town. Walked in there and into the Red Cross, and they said, well, we can't give you any money, we can't do anything for you, you know. It was very disappointing. So I went back to the base, and I'm telling the guys, and somebody got hold of it, and I got a call from our commanding officer, who was a Major Allman. He said, pack your bags, be down at the airstrip in half an hour. Yes, sir. Threw some stuff in my sea bag, down, sitting on the edge of the airstrip. Major Ullman came over, I jumped up, you know, and saluted. And I mean, nobody ever got, on my level, ever got to talk to the major. He said, come on over to the hangar. Went over there and we got in an SBD dive bomber. That's a two-seater. I sat in the back, he piloted, he flew me right to Albany Airport. Gave me $20 out of his own pocket. And he said he got, I think it was 5 days pass, 5 days off. Well, unfortunately, I didn't get back in time to see my brother alive, but...
you got to see your family.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice gesture.
Yeah, you know, at a bad time like that.
Yeah.
So I lost my brother at that time.
So then you went back to the base after the 5 days?
Yeah. Did you have to go back on your own, or did they come and get you?
No, they don't come and get you. You make your own way back. Mm-hmm. They better not be late.
Yeah.
Because you're AWOL and they throw you right in the brink. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much World War II there. Now, Korea, yeah, we shipped out from Camp Pendleton, landed in Korea, I think it was in September, It was starting to get pretty cold out. We were there only a few days, and we loaded everybody and supplies aboard a Korean train, which is a narrow gauge railroad, much smaller than ours here. And we started to move north, because at that time we were trying to push the Koreans back over the 38th parallel. So all we had on at that time, or had available outside of our work clothes, was khaki pants and shirts like that. Well, they loaded these open gondolas, and we climbed up on top of those, and that's where we rode for the next 2 or 3 days, heading north. And in the meantime, it was getting pretty darn cold. It was starting to snow a little bit, and we were pretty cold at that time. So we'd get into our sea bag where we could, get more stuff out and put it on, you know. And finally, we got up to the base of this mountain pass that went about 30 miles up into these steep, rugged mountains. Kind of similar to what it is here, only larger mountains. And it was a narrow road from the foot of those mountains up about 30 miles, and it was on a cliffside, where the cliff is on one side, a little narrow road, and then dropped right straight down on the other side. And we rode this little train up this little railroad, which paralleled that other road, to what we call the railhead. And it was at the dam at the Chosen Reservoir. We unloaded everything on the train right there, and that was the storage depot at the railhead that they talked about. And basically that's where I stayed until I got out of there. Now, a few miles up the road, 4 or 5 miles, was the Chosen Reservoir itself. The MacArthur and his team said, the Chinese will never get into this war, you know. We're going to be home by Christmas and all this sort of thing. Well, of course that didn't happen. When the Yalu River froze over at the Chosen Reservoir up there, and the reservoir froze over, 200,000 Chinese communists came across the ice, came around, surrounded us, and we were trapped. So conditions really went downhill then. We didn't have everything we needed. We had no winter clothing. Temperatures were going down below zero. We still were able to get some supplies in by air. They would drop bundles of clothing and stuff. But they had no real winter clothing for us. And there just wasn't any available anyplace. As Marines were killed, the only way we could stay alive even was to salvage clothing from them. Right down to socks, pants, boots, jackets. So anyway, it was at this railhead. We had a little shack there. It was probably as big as this little enclosure we're in right here. It had a dividing wall down the middle. And we set up a switchboard inside. And we had a little pot burner stove where the fuel just runs in and burns. And so we put a diesel fuel outside, piped it in through the copper line, lit the thing. We ran a little while and went out. The line was frozen up. It was getting really cold. So we put on a barrel of kerosene. Kerosene froze up. So the only thing we had left was aviation gas. We put a barrel of that on, and then we didn't have any problem. But that was the only heat in that area. It was in that little this little room where we had the switchboard. Now, the wall down the middle partitioned the switchboard off from the morgue. As Marines got killed, shot, died, they would bring them down and stack them in this room, stand them up, because it wasn't that much space, until that room got filled, and then they had to pile them outside and cover them with a tarp or something. And, well, it was very tough up there. The worst thing I remember outside of trying to stay alive with the Chinese communists and all, and the firing, and was the cold. The cold was so pervasive up there, it would get to 30, even 40 below zero. There was no way you could stay warm, no matter what you put on. You could not stay warm. If you got just a minor wound and it wasn't taken care of right away, you'd die, because the shock and the cold would kill you. Companies of Marines that went up there, maybe 50 or 60 men in a company, when we finally got out of there, there'd be maybe 4 or 5 men left. Others were casualties or dead. Well, we went through that for about 6 weeks, I think it was. One of the worst possible experiences was at night. We posted guards and everything, but who would shoot anything that moved, because we were surrounded by these communists. And the worst possible thing was if you had to go to the bathroom at night. I mean, it sounds like a funny thing or something, but it was really horrible. They had what they called a slip trench up on the side of a hill. It's just a narrow trench, 3 foot long, 2 foot deep. You had to get up there, do what you had to do with your clothing and everything. The wind might be blowing 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, 35, 40 below zero. Plus, if you got up there, you were lucky, because your own men would shoot you if you didn't know the password. I particularly remember that as being very, very difficult. One of the things we did while we were up there, we had to establish communications from the railhead down out of these mountains. So we ran down this little narrow gauge railroad. We found axles and wheels, and we put together, and some planking, and we put together a little flatbed cart for the rails. Put the wire reels on the back of that. And for brakes, this was downhill all the way, so we had 2x4s, essentially, to wedge against the wheels to stop the cart when we had to stop it. So it was going along pretty good. We were using a old cable that we had found and tested it, and it was all right. It wasn't American made, it was Korean. I think it was made in Japan, come to think of it. So we ran this cable. We got down about 8 or 10 miles, and we took a bunch of fire coming at us, so we had to drop it then. But another crew had worked up, and they made the connection. When everything was done, about 3 calls went through, and the line was cut in 100 pieces. I mean, the communists just cut it up. So it was quite an experience. I remember going into down this railroad, and we came to this tunnel. We had to lay the wire through the tunnel, and you couldn't see the other end, so we didn't know what we were running into in there. It was pitch black. So we just let it go, and we kept going. Pretty soon we came to the other end, and when we came out of the other end, we were on a trestle, a big pine trestle. It was that kind of territory over there. At the end of decided that if we wanted to stay alive, we had to get out of there, because if the Chinese didn't kill us, the cold would have. And actually, the cold was in our favor in one way, because it was even harder on the Chinese than it was on us. Their clothing, when they got wet, they had an awful time getting dry, and they couldn't build a fire because Marines had Corsairs, and they would drop napalm on them. When they did that, they'd run maybe 20 or 30 feet, just a flame, run and drop and die right there. And when they died from napalm, their whole body would shrink. They'd be maybe 3 foot long, coal black, burned completely. Mm. So, I don't know how true it is, but the story was that Smith, I think, was our commander then, and somebody said, you have to retreat. He said, retreat hell, we're going to fight in another direction, which is essentially what we had to do. As the guys at the reservoir came down past us with what vehicles they could carry or drive. Well, one more thing, that if you shut a vehicle off for 30 minutes, you could not start it again. It was frozen. So we always had to keep something, one or two vehicles running to push the other ones to start them. But when they came down, if this was the hood of a Jeep, they'd have three bodies lashed down on the hood. A couple more, three or four stacked in the back. And of course, they were frozen solid. You know. As they came down past us, we fell in behind them with all everything that we had and our dead Marines and all. As we got about a half mile away from the railhead there, our engineering people had wired everything, then they blew everything up. So we were fighting our way all the way out, because they were on the ridges all around us, firing down on us. We had squads of Marines up on the ridges, coming along a little bit ahead of us, trying to wipe them out as they came down. That particular morning, I remember it was very close to 40 below zero. Anyway, we got down this road a ways, and the Chinese had blown a portion of the road out, and that was the only way out. There was no other way out. So they got on the radios, and I don't know to this day who they called, but they had somebody bring in and drop some girders. So everybody pitched in, and then we built a bridge right there at this blown out portion of the road. And we got if a truck failed or anything, or they put bullets through the engine or something, we just pushed it over the side, get it off the road, out of the way. So we got past that, and eventually we got down to the foothill, you know, down. The 10th Army Corps was down at the foot of the thing there. So we kept going, and we got over to, it took us to Ham Nung, Hung Nam, Twin Cities there. And there was a big, huge beach, and they had unloaded supplies at that. That's where they unloaded everything. Put us aboard ships, and in the meantime, the North Koreans and civilians had come down this road where they could, stayed with us, and you never knew if they were on your side or the enemy's side. They came down, they loaded them aboard the ships along with us, and anything we could carry, and when the last people were aboard ship, and we pulled off about a mile there, they blew the whole beach, which would be an area larger than this town, blew all the supplies sky high. before those supplies hit the ground, the Chinese were already in the supplies, salvaging what they could. We went down the coast to, I think it was Wonsan. And I remember they told us where to set up, where to take cover there and all. And there was a CB battalion. I can't think of the name there. I guess it was this. That's not the word I'm looking for. But anyway, they had showers set up there. This was behind our lines then, where they finally were saved by that time. They had showers. They were baking their own bread. Oh, that's the other thing. When we were in the trap up there, we lived on either one can of sea rations, which is like a can of soup, or maybe sometimes, if we had enough, if they had dropped enough, two cans. Mm. And that was, and you had to keep them in your shirt, along with your canteen, so it wouldn't freeze up, or you couldn't eat or drink the water. And they were baking bread. We got in the showers, we got cleaned up. Everybody stripped naked down there, piled all our clothing, everything we had on, burned the whole pile, issued us new clothing. And then we had about three or four weeks, we didn't have to do a thing. Mm. And they said that at that time, the 1st Marine Division will never fight as a unit again, because they had taken so many casualties and so decimated. About 3 weeks later, okay, saddle up, we're moving. We're right back working again. They brought in replacements and all. It was the same old thing again. Then we were out in the walking another fellow and myself. Well, he was a sergeant at that time. I was a corporal. We were walking a pole line looking for a bad wire. And I stepped on a landmine. And the last thing I remembered is like being 4 or 5 feet in the air. And when I came to, I didn't hear anything. And I called for Bob. He was the sergeant. He was behind me about 30 feet. I called for him, and I didn't get any answer. So I thought we had been mortared. I thought it was a mortar that they were dropping on us. Anyway, I crawled over to where he was. Piece of shrapnel had hit him right between the eyes. Bleeding very badly. He was already dead for all intents and purposes. And I held on to him. He died in my arms. I was there a few minutes, and this Red Cross truck came along the road, a closed truck like a van. I flagged them down, and they took us to a field hospital. Well, I was in the field hospital about a week. I had broken eardrums and little pieces of shrapnel all over me. But those landmines, when you step on them, they blow outwards, you know, mostly. And that's why he caught the shrapnel behind me there. And about a week later, I found out where my old unit had moved to, and they had reported me missing in action. Now, a telegram came home to my mother and father. Your son is missing in action. And of course, it didn't make them too happy. So, got through that. And then, not too long after that, I got a battlefield promotion, you might say, because I took the sergeant's place, so I became sergeant. And then I was in charge of the wire team and running wire and all this. And then we shipped home. So that in a nutshell is...
Were you there through the end of hostilities? Were the peace talks going on while you were there?
don't really remember if I was there at that time or not. But I remember the peace talks went on for years about the 38th parallel. But I guess it was a truce line in any event. So, came home and what did they do then? I went to work for Western Electric for a while.
Well, before I forget, you mentioned you had two Purple Hearts.
I got one Purple Heart in Japan for a reason that I don't believe I should have had. I had fungus infection of the ears. And they gave me a Purple Heart for that.
Yeah,
I didn't even want it. And I mean, if the guys find out about it, they raise, they tease the hell out of you. Mm-hmm. And the second one for when I stepped on the landmine.
Mm-hmm. How was the medical treatment?
Primitive. Very primitive.
Did you have any occasion to see what they called the MASH unit there, the mobile hospitals?
Well, technically, when I stepped on the landmine and they took us to this field hospital, which was a tent about as large as this area, it was like you would see on MASH there, but not as large. Very, very primitive. Two or three corpsmen in there. I don't think they even had a doctor.
Okay, so then you must have been very happy to be coming home.
I was happy to be alive, happy to get back to the family, yeah.
How did you get back to the States?
We flew from Korea to Japan, and then by boat all the way back, to San Diego, where I had left.
Then from San Diego, did they furnish you transportation, or did you have to do that on your own?
They paid us. They gave us our pay. Because the Marine Corps was very funny. You couldn't help but save your money because they wouldn't give it to you. I mean, it was in your name. It was there. But they'd have what they called pay muster. You'd fall out and call Alan and go up there and show him your dog tag, and they'd give you $5. It was just to buy things that you had to have, toothpaste and shaving cream, stuff like that. And that's how they kept control. They didn't want you going out and getting drunk and all that sort of thing.
When did your family find out that you were not missing in action anymore? Or did they find out when you walked through the door?
No, I think I called them from someplace when I got close to Albany. Can't remember now even where. I told them I was there and I was coming home.
And that must have been a happy day.
Oh, very, very.
Mm-hmm. Did they have a special banquet for you when you got home?
No.
Oh, not all your favorite foods?
No, I never saw any of these victory marches or anything like
that.
I was just glad to be home.
Well, yeah. So then
I came partway. I forget how I did it. I ended up in downtown Albany. And again, I went to the train station there, and I hitched a ride up to the West Albany shops, up in that area, up Water Fleet Avenue way. In the meantime, my mother and father had moved out to Fira Bush, so I had no idea where we lived or anything. And my mother got a ride with somebody. My father was working. And she was coming down Water Fleet Avenue, and I got a ride, and I rode in the locomotive with the engineer. He came up through, he was going up through the line, heading west through West Albany. When he came to Water Fleet Avenue, he stopped the train, let me get off, and I knew where I was then because I was brought up right in that area. Walked up Water Fleet Avenue, my mother was walking down. Oh, it was good coming home.
Yeah, so you didn't get much mail from home that time, or were you able to send mail, or from Korea?
No,
because you were trapped soon.
Every once in a while you'd hear, well, we lost the mail, or mail ship went down, that sort of thing. you didn't get much in the line of mail.
Were you bombarded with propaganda from the North Koreans?
I don't remember ever seeing any, really. Mm-hmm. And really, the North Koreans were secondary because of the Chinese communists came in. And of course, they controlled the North Koreans anyway. But I think MacArthur was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people have said that we've interviewed, and others thought he was right, and who knows? We can't change things.
Right.
So then when you got home and you got settled, you went back to work or school?
No, I never went back to school. I lived to regret that in later life. But what I did do, I went to work for Western Electric at that time. And, you're not from this area, so you probably don't know Norma Wally, do you? Norma. She's affiliated with this.
Oh, yes. But we interviewed her husband.
Oh, yes.
That's
Steve.
All I know her by.
Okay. Steve and I worked together down at Western Electric.
Oh.
In fact, I introduced them, those two, and they got married.
Yeah.
Then I was out of work for a while. Then I met my wife. We got married. Things were pretty tough. I didn't have a job at that time or anything. That was after I left Western Electric. And a fellow said, well, come on down to the old college that was a state university. Well, it wasn't a state university yet.
Mm-hmm.
It was the old college down in Western Washington Avenue.
Albany State.
Yeah, Albany State. Went to work there as a steam fireman. And they said, well, you have to, if you don't pass the test when it comes up, then we have to let you go. So I studied the books and everything. And I passed the test. I got 98.6 on the test. That was the third highest in New York State.
Great.
Because I had done a lot of studying.
Uh-huh.
Well, then I took the next test that came up, which was for a stationary engineer. Got a 90-something on that. At that time, they started building the state university, the big state university. And they needed somebody to open the heating plant up there. So I got picked for that. They sent me up there, told me to hire 5 firemen, 5 engineers, and just hang around, and look at the plant, make sure how it operates and everything. So that fall, we had the heat turned on up there, and there was no load, because there was only 1 or 2 buildings halfway completed. So it was pretty easy going that winter, except the equipment that was put in and the controls and everything. You know, nothing works right when they first do it and they have to go back. So anyway, I did that for the next 23 years.
Mm.
I was actually the first supervisor to be on the Albany University campus.
Oh. Well, we're running out of time. This has been very interesting.
Oh.
And we thank you so much for your service to our country and for doing this interview.
And anyway, I retired from there, and I was chief of utilities there for many years.
That's good.